Welcome to the Off the Charts Football Podcast. I'm Matt Manicharian of Sports Info Solutions, joined by Aaron Schatz, the godfather of football analytics. And on today's episode, we have a very special guest, Neil Stratton from Inside the League. He's been around here before. We have him back today because he wrote a new book. It's called Scout Speak, Thinking and Talking About Being an NFL Evaluator. It's got a foreword by Jeff Ireland. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's the assistant GM for the New Orleans Saints. Most of all, we're just excited to have Neil back on to talk shop a little bit at this most interesting times of the football calendar. So, Neil, what is up?
Matt, it's an honor to be here with you and Aaron. I really appreciate y'all having me on. I'm excited to talk about the book, but I'm more excited to chop it up with a couple guys that are true football people, man. So thanks again for having me on.
Yeah, man. Thank you for joining us. All right, let's start off. Since the last time we spoke, at least on the podcast, you were out trying to help people get tested in the spring. It was kind of early in the COVID process. What have you been up to since then? What's life been like for you during the last several months?
Well, for the most part, life has kind of been, I don't want to call it normal, but from a professional standpoint, more or less smooth sailing. You alluded to the fact that we were trying to help with pro days in March and April, and we did a lot of that and really kind of thought we'd shut the door on that. I'm starting to think that might be something that happens again next March and April. Just kind of using our network of former NFL scouts and trying to place them with different agents and different teams and different schools and what have you to get that done. Other than that, you know, obviously we came into April, March and April, May, kind of had a little bit of time on my hands that I wasn't expecting. So I had all these notes, I had all these different seminars that I'd hosted and symposiums and places where I'd spoken and all those kind of things. And I had all these different transcriptions. And so I decided, you know, maybe this would make a book. And so I kind of put it all together and started organizing it and got to about 25,000 words with a lot of interesting topics. And then you got to get to about 40 to have a 150 page book. So I spent about another month just trying to decide what direction do I want to go? Who do I want to speak to? I did a few more interviews and then did a little bit more writing to kind of tie it all together. And then pretty much had the book written about by June. And then it took me another month and a half to get it really where it needed to be. And so we got it published a couple weeks ago. So the summer has been really working on the book. The summer has been trying to get ready for the coming season. You kind of get all your wood chopped, and we do team scouting reports for all the teams and kind of look at the top 10 NFL prospects, not dependent upon class for each Division I team, for every FBS team. You know, and then this last month has been surprisingly a lot more tracking the signings. That is kind of the bread and butter of what we do, is tracking what player signing with what agency and kind of where they're going to train, those kind of things, which is normally something that doesn't happen until around New Year's Day. But nothing's been normal this year. So that's already kind of taken place with the opt-outs, which has made the season a lot more interesting than normally is.
Right. So for people that don't know, Inside the League is a company that Neil runs, which is a consultancy of sorts for any sort of person inside the football business. So insiders like agents use Inside the League. There's nobody more tapped in with different evaluators and the scouts around the league, and oftentimes the players themselves, which is why Neil has the interesting insight on this book. So you're saying that your yearly timeline has sort of changed a little bit because of all the early declarations that are coming now?
Yes, and they're making decisions about coming out. Their agents are responding in that way. You know, we track the business from every angle, as you know, Matt, and one of those is with the agencies, and it's really amazing the expenditures that the firms are having to make to sign the top players that are coming out now. That's not something that really interests the fans. I mean, that doesn't really affect what happens on Sunday per se. But from an industry standpoint, you know, people across the game who are working the business, it's really been a sea change in how things have been done and the amount of money that has to be spent up front and how agencies are having to react to that because, obviously everyone's a little bit down economically right now, financially, and here we are having to adjust upwards kind of in their budgets and what have you. So from that standpoint, it's been a very different year so far. And for those that don't know, I also write a blog called Succeed in Football. And just for people that are interested, a little peek behind the curtain, I wrote a blog post this week that talks about the cost of representing a player now based on where they're rated to be drafted. And that's gotten a good bit of discussion on Twitter because it's just something that people don't think about. And I think most agents, and you know this, Matt, you know this, Aaron, people think that agents will make an expenditure up front and the player pays it back. that's not the case at all. In some cases, you're, as an agent, you're gambling hundreds of thousands of dollars that the player will do well during his first contract, make that second contract, and be able to make your money back then. It's just such a, it's a very difficult business model if you're in player representation right now.
And keep you. You have to gamble that the player will not only do well and get that second contract, but keep you as the agent through that
second contract. Absolutely right. Absolutely right. And when you're the player these days, and right or wrong, you hold all the cards. It's not difficult to terminate an agent and more or less walk away for, really, you don't have to show cause. You just walk away because you don't like them. And for that reason, there are a lot of things that are being offered to players. There's a lot of different things, and it's just, you know, a very complicated landscape and probably the subject of my next book, actually.
So somebody like a Ja'Marr Chase you're talking about right now, he's going to be more expensive than that sort of a prospect has ever been before, even in the context of an economy that's down 10%, 20%, whatever your estimate is on that.
Absolutely right. And a player like that who comes from a blue chip school, who scores touchdowns, is going to command a marketing guarantee or a stipend, whatever you want to call it, of, you know, six figures. And then anywhere from $7,000 to $10,000 a month through the draft. So that's a pretty nice chunk of change. You're in about $200,000 just before he even gets the draft. And, you know, the draft is such a fickle business, as you both know. Today's first pick in the draft could be the 32nd pick in the draft, or who knows, even later. I mean, the last 3 years, we've seen guys that weren't even rated as second day go as the first pick in the draft. So it's a very, you know, it's a very mercurial industry. And when you're gambling that kind of money, you got to be really careful about how you spend it.
Well, interestingly, one of the things that makes it so mercurial is how players perform in their final season. So I wanted to ask you, now we're getting players who, because of COVID, are opting out of their final season and basically just declaring for the draft right away without playing what is effectively their junior year. Do you see that as something that's temporary, or do you think that this is going to be a sea change, that even when COVID goes away, that we're going to see players in college that played two good years decline to play their third year?
2 months ago, I asked that to several scouts. I said, you know, how many players can really realistically skip their last season of play and be able to hold their draft status? The number that I got was 10 to 20. Now, we're going to see a lot more than 10 to 20 players opt out of the draft, and they're coming from everywhere in the draft. And Matt, I'm sure you have an opinion on this as well as a former NFL scout yourself. But I do think this is something that's going to become very commonplace. You know, the market is showing that these players will be able to come out and they will be get paid this. I mean, like I alluded to earlier, they're getting paid $7,000 to $8,000 a month to do nothing but train. That's on top of the training expenses, the housing expenses, all those kind of things. And I don't know how far y'all want to go down this road, but I think Trevor Lawrence and Justin Fields are a bit of an anomaly right now. Those are both guys that could easily step away. And you credit Justin Fields, he's fighting to try to get the Big Ten back on the field. But those guys definitely could. And, you know, you're seeing that in bowl play already. I think you will now see, especially among the players who are getting that big stipend, that big per diem, they're going to start walking away more commonly. And presuming a Ja'Marr Chase still goes top 10 and some of these other players still go around where you expected them to, if that's tested out and it comes to happen, then it's going to be Katie bar the door. And I don't say that. I'm not excited about that. I'm a big fan of college football, but I think it is a real reality of the marketplace right now. And I think that's something that college football fans need to start getting used to.
That's interesting if you think about the way the NBA changed years and years ago with the one and done rule. And football, you know, going back to Maurice Claret, the 3 years out rule has been challenged before and it's held up. It seems like just things are changing so much in college football that whenever things do get back to normal, which seems like it might be 2022 before things are really, you know, sort of new normal, I think that new normal is going to look very different, especially from a financial portion of things. And so that certainly has an impact on this question you're talking about too.
Yeah. And I, you know, then that's another great aspect to this, Matt. I mean, that a lot of people aren't talking about. We don't know what kind of impact this is going to have on the Big Ten. I mean, without having fans in the stands and even on TV and what have you, it's going to have impact on every sport that a university plays, as well as the amount of scholarships they can offer, the salaries they can pay to coaches, the size of the staffs. And, you know, in the Big Ten, some of these staffs are enormous. So, I mean, you're going to see a lot of things happen, and I think it could affect recruiting down the line. I mean, I don't want to make too much of this because it is pretty wide ranging, and everyone's going to suffer this to some degree, so it's going to be a bit relative. But at the same time, I think the Pac-12 and the Big Ten are really going to have something to grapple with over the next. This is probably going to, you know, this is probably going to affect them for a year to 2 years, maybe 3 years down the line.
So I want to get back to the book, but I think we're on an interesting road here for a minute. So I wanted to kind of stay there. So you're in really Big 12 country there. What is your expectation for Big 12 this football season? Do you think what does the schedule end up looking like? Where do you see things going? Me and Aaron are up here in the Northeast. We don't have as good a sense.
Well, you know, down here, things are a lot more spread out. And whereas in the Northeast, I think things are a little bit more compact. And so I think the way that things have worked out, it's been a little, we haven't had as many challenges as what y'all face in the Northeast. Because of that, I think there's a better chance that they get through at least an 8-9 game schedule. I don't know that it looks like, obviously, your average year, but I do think that there's a good chance of getting through. And I think maybe by the end of the season, we start to see fans in the stands, you know, at the 25. I'm not well versed in the relative capacities and limits they've made at each of the Big 12 campuses. But I think by the end of the season, we could see, I'm hoping, at least 25, maybe 50% of the stadiums at capacity going forward. And, you know, again, that's just speculation. But being here in Texas and knowing more or less what's going on in Louisiana, what's going on in Oklahoma, that area, I think there's a good chance. And obviously, it's big-time football country. They're going to go – I think that most programs will go to every length that they need to make sure that this happens one way or another. So I'm optimistic about it, but I certainly am also understanding that, you know, if we see a second wave of some kind, if there's a failure in testing, if technology doesn't continue to improve, if number of cases doesn't drop, then that could all change. But I guess I'm keeping my fingers crossed and my toes crossed and hoping that we have as near a normal season as we possibly can.
Going back to the book, talk about who the book is for. You're talking about thinking and talking about being an NFL evaluator. Is this for people who are trying to look into getting into scouting? Is it for folks who are already into it and are looking to sort of upgrade their knowledge? Is it just for general fans? What are you thinking on the readership?
It's a great question, Aaron. I think I was in college when fantasy football really started kind of going up. And I think that exposed the deepest inner secrets of a lot of people that everyone kind of in their hearts wants to be a scout or maybe even thinks they're a scout. Not everyone reaches the heights that, you know, that Matt made it to. But everyone kind of nurses that dream of one day being an NFL scout and be able to sit in a war room and call shots and make picks and all those kind of things. And, you know, after all, that's what Draft Twitter is all about, right? So I think I wrote it to some degree for that segment of society. But the interesting thing is that I've had a lot of my friends in scouting say, hey, man, I just got my book. Or some will say, I just got it and I read it all the way through in one sitting. I'm like, man, you're the one person who doesn't need to read this book. But everyone loves a good war story. Everyone loves a good, you know, an insight about the industry that they might not have thought of. Everyone loves the observations. Everyone wants to know how other people are doing it. There's a lot in there that kind of is draft, I mean, scouting 101. I mean, I talk about the difference between a college scout and a pro scout. I talk about how much a young scout makes versus maybe a more seasoned scout. I talk about the progression from area scout to assistant director to director to DPP to GM, you know, kind of how the career advances. But there's also a lot in there about, you know, kind of the ins and outs of it and what it's like to be on the road. And at the end of the last chapter is nothing but war stories. And so we talk about when the Saints had a chance to get Reggie Bush and why the Texans took Mario Williams. And we kind of got it from both sides there. And we talk about the undrafted free agent process, which is kind of like the, you know, it's like the boiler room of the NFL draft. You know, everyone's making crazy calls and trying to do this and trying to do that and promises that are made 1 second or forgotten the next second and all those kind of things. So I think there's a level of interest for everyone from the guy who wants to be a scout to the person who's always thought about it but just really wants to know more about it, to the fantasy football person who wants to know what's it really like to evaluate these people, to even the people who are in the industry that already kind of know everything to know about scouting but want to hear different perspectives and kind of hear different information. So I think there's a lot of different tiers for it. At the end of the day, if you're a football fan, I think you'll enjoy it. I think there's a lot of color in there. There's a lot of good stories. There's a lot of things that you might not have thought of. And so I'm hopeful that it's an easy read, without a lot of big words, because I don't know many big words, something that everyone can get grapple and come away from and have a better, be able to enjoy the game on Sundays more so than they had before they read the book.
Yeah, Neil, I'm dying to read it. I'm waiting for my copy in the mail. But the reason that I'm waiting for it so much is exactly what you just talked about. If you're with one team, you're only with one team. There's 31 other teams out there, and you don't get those stories, because if you did get them, you know, the real, true, unvarnished stories, then those other teams are doing a bad idea. Mm-hmm. You get different versions of different things from people on the road, and this is a little bit of that. But it's always interesting, because even if you are an insider, I think that it's something that you're always interested in sort of hearing about. I was going to ask you for sort of an interesting story from there, and you already brought one up that piqued my interest. So I can imagine from the New Orleans side of the Reggie Bush pick, they never expect him to be there. When he's available, you know, they're running the card in, all that kind of stuff. Well, what's the story of that from the other side of things? Was there a lot of dissent in terms of passing him over? What's the other side of that story? Can you give us a little sneak peek?
It's really interesting, because the Texans had just kind of gone over to the Denver Broncos model. And I think, you know, one thing that a lot of people don't understand, a lot of people think, oh, well, you've got scouts and they go out and they make all the decisions and then they come in and they tell the GM who to draft. Not at all.
Okay. Yeah.
So you have different models. One model that you have out there is the Denver Broncos model, which is more, hey, we're going to let the scouts bring us the players. And then when the coaches get done in December, then they're going to kind of take over and they're going to have a lot more input into how the selections are made. Because after all, they're the ones, you know, they're the cooks in the kitchen, right? So the Texans, I know that they were starting to see more of a Denver Broncos. You know what it was? Rick Smith had just come in as GM. So he came from Denver, and their model was more so, we're going to trust the coaches. And so they had a lot of success with, you know, Terrell Davis, who was really more kind of a system runner. This was when they were just starting the one cut offense and those kind of things. And so everyone's in the room looking at Reggie Bush, and they're starting to look at Mario Williams as well. I mean, after all, they've got a guy in their division named Peyton Manning, who's a pretty big difference maker, and they'd had trouble beating the Colts. And so they get down to where the room's kind of split. And so they bring one coach in, and he's the defensive coach, and he's going to talk about Mario Williams. And they bring a coach in, and he's going to talk about Reggie Bush. Well, the first coach comes in, he talks about Bush, and he's good. And he puts the film on, he kind of lets the film tell the story. And, you know, after all, everyone who remembers what Reggie Bush did in his last season at USC, I mean, remarkable stuff, history making. But he didn't say much. So he kind of puts the film on, and everyone kind of oohs and ahs. They're like, yeah, you know, Reggie, he's a good player. And then they bring the defensive line coach in, and he puts Mario Williams' film on. And he starts breaking it down. Look at Mario, how he breaks down here. Look when he comes off the edge, see how he bends. Look how he moves his foot. Look how, okay, this was a third and long situation. Look how he adjusted his play. Look how he pursues the running back down the field, whereas these other defensive ends are kind of watching the play. And he really painted a picture that made everyone in the room think, maybe Mario Williams is the pick now. And then the running backs coach came in, who had a Broncos history, and he said, listen, we had a lot of success with guys just plugging and playing. A lot of those guys, you know, I think Terrell Davis, correct me if I'm wrong, was an undrafted free agent. And maybe he was a late rounder.
Sixth round pick, I believe.
Sixth rounder, right. Yeah.
Okay, right. You know, when he left, they had a succession of other guys that I think were undrafted or late round.
And Landis kind of Gary.
All those guys, exactly. Landis Gary and all those guys. Plug and play, they come in and get 1,000 yards. So the running backs coach, who everyone thought would be the big Reggie Bush advocate, comes in and says, we don't need Reggie Bush. We can find a running back anywhere who can run our offense and still be successful. Let's get a defensive end who can put pressure on Peyton Manning. And that's when everything kind of shifted. And I think GM Charlie Cassidy was leaning Mario Williams. And I think he's given credit to the guy that, you know, that made that pick. But the truth is, kind of the defensive line coach really is kind of who sold the whole team on the idea of taking Mario. And you can argue, I mean, Mario Williams is an impact player for a long time, kind of tailed off at the end. You can argue about who had the more successful career. It probably is Williams. But at the very least, I think a lot of people thought, oh, my gosh, you passed on a generational talent here to fill a need. That really wasn't the case. And you can kind of see why, in retrospect, it was the right pick for him.
Back in 2006, we were shocked. But what we've learned over the last few years, we would be like, oh, yeah, that's absolutely the right move. You take the defensive end over the running back based on positional value, like even if Bush is a generational talent.
Mm-hmm. This is a great example of why running backs don't matter has a kernel of truth to it, but also is one of the most misused phrases by analytics Twitter, because the truth is that Mike Shanahan and all those, like you said, Neil, all those Broncos teams, they saw this a long time ago, and they understood that the marginal value of Mario Williams is going to be more than Reggie Bush 9 times out of 10. And that's, I think, exactly how it played out with their careers. So it's really fascinating that whole story kind of ties back to a very analytics-y sort of theme.
And it's also interesting to talk. I mean, I talked to a Saints scout who was there that day when they found out. Everyone, I think there's a perception that people thought maybe that the Saints knew all along and the Texans kind of knew all along. It was on Friday that Loomis came in and cleared the draft room and said, hey, guys, y'all go home early. We've got a decision. It looks like something's about to happen. And so it's kind of interesting to hear both sides of the story and how it all developed and all those kind of things, which is fascinating. And I mean, I'd like to go through every draft. There's always a couple players where you're like, wow, they didn't want that guy, but they wind up with this other guy, and he was the one that worked out, and the one they wanted didn't work out. So that's part of the draft intrigue that I think really gives it a mystique.
What I love behind the curtain that you said there about this coach delivering his report on Mario Williams, number one, you said he painted a picture. And that's always, if I learned one thing from Ryan Pace in New Orleans, it was paint a picture when you write an evaluation. As a scout, you are not just someone who watches the players. You are someone who communicates what you see. And so the ability to paint a picture, I think, is what separates scouts a lot of the time. The other thing that he did is he brought a lot of evidence to the table. And that's the Michael Lombardi hallmark is when I wrote reports for him, I learned to do things like point out a specific play, a specific moment where you can actually see a trait and point it out to somewhere else where they can see it. So it's interesting to hear you bring up that and hear kind of two of the most important things that I think a scout can do in terms of bringing a player to the table. And those are two of the really effective things that were done in that context.
If you get on Twitter or really you read almost any draft report from someone, they start using all the terms knee bender and all those whatever, and all the terms you can hear. But to really bring it together in a way that makes it comprehensive and allows you to kind of see the player in your head, I think that's what makes scouts – that separates the good scout from the great scout.
So I have a curious question. We talk a lot on this show about how analytics has developed over the last few years and things that people have sort of discovered and believe now compared to a few years ago. How would you say that scouting has changed over the last few years? Is there sort of certain opinions about types of players that have significantly changed in what most scouts believe or what most scouts are looking for?
I could see how it's changed in the last 5 to 6 years in a couple ways. I think analytics has become a much bigger part of the game when you look at how quarterbacks are evaluated. Accuracy is so much more important than it used to be. I think it used to be big arm and general mobility and do they fit all the criteria as far as height, weight, speed, that kind of thing. But now it's so much more about can he hit his target when he needs to. Blake Bedingfield's a good friend of mine who was college director for the Titans for a long time. When they evaluated quarterbacks, they threw out everything that was 5 yards and under. They only wanted routes that were mid and long to see how really accurate a quarterback was. I mean, everyone can make a dump off, right? Everyone can throw a screen pass. Everyone can throw a simple square in, but can you throw the deep out? Can you throw, all those routes that need a little bit more of threading of the needle? And I think that's an important part of it. The other part of it, I think, is it's a monkey see, monkey do league. And so where scouts would say how it's changed is a lot more teams have gone to the New England model where they're bringing in young scouts to go out and get hard facts, height, weight, speed, arrests, suspensions, whatever they can get from the pro liaison, whatever they can get from body types, whatever they can get just from going and watching a practice, bring it all home. And then shut your mouth. We're not asking you to make decisions. We're not even really asking you to evaluate per se. We'll let the guys at the director level, the GM, what have you, make those decisions. That really works if you're New England. Well, I guess you could argue that whether or not it works in New England, they haven't had the best drafts. But it doesn't necessarily work for every other team. But because that's a good economic model, you can pay your scouts less and you can find them younger and cheaper and what have you. A lot of teams have adapted that. I don't know why this is, Matt. You may be able to answer this. every team, when they want to make cuts to their bottom line, to their P&L, they go to the draft, the scouting room first, and they want to get rid of their old guys, or they want to make sure they're hiring younger guys or making less money. And you know, that's the R&D department of your team. And I mean, I always like to say this is like having 32, 42 Fortune 500 companies for the amount of money they're bringing in. They're saving pennies, relatively speaking, by cutting scouts and not making them their most highly compensated employees. And then they wonder why they can't do so well on draft day. It's a real paradox to me.
You know, I can't explain why people don't invest in things that I think they should invest in. I certainly believe that investing in strategy, investing in scouting, investing, you know, teams spend more on some individual coaches than they do on their entire scouting staffs.
Right.
So, and that's not capped money at all either. So it's tough to explain that. Although when you look at the way decisions have historically been made, you can understand why that's been something that's been devalued. The one thing I'll say is, you know, you don't consider yourself an analytics guy, I know, but you do track a lot of really interesting data. And the data supports what you just said, that the positions have changed. Scouts are getting younger. In some cases, they're getting more plentiful, but really their roles becoming, I think, more the information gatherers rather than opining on players in a way that you used to see. Mm-hmm. And I think there's some value to that because you're focusing on bringing in that objective information. Yeah. But I think as we see things evolve over time, it'll become more like we see in other sports where, you know, baseball tried scaling back on scouts a long time ago, and they've gone in the opposite direction with that. They've really valued scouts that have research chops and people that have the ability to do both as something that they've invested in more. But they certainly haven't gone away from people with expertise on the sport and valuing that sort of knowledge. So I do think, you know, we've seen it in basketball. I think it's going to kind of head back in that direction in football, but it's very unfortunate for some of the experienced scouts who really have never been fully appreciated for what they're doing. And I would love for the analytics world to fast forward into the future when everybody realizes, oh, wow, those guys had data. We just didn't really know what to do with the data that they were providing, rather than skipping forward to let's just use the data that we can provide, you know, the charting data, the combine data, et cetera, and ignore them. Until 5-10 years from now, we realized that they actually had something that would fit really well in our models.
Someone is talking about analytics versus traditional scouting. Once you integrate them, whoever figures out how to integrate them, they're going to have the keys of the kingdom, Matt. But a lot of people have to get past this. It's either one or the other, you know.
And scouts and analytics are in the same boat when it comes to this paying for them problem, because here's the deal. There's no salary cap on how many scouts you can hire.
Exactly.
And there's no salary cap on how many analytics people you can hire. Mm-hmm. And they don't cost as much as players. Mm-hmm. So why don't you hire a lot of them, like in both categories?
I think the Browns have gotten beaten up a lot because they're seen as the analytics model and what have you. There's pluses and minuses to that. But one thing I'll say about the Browns, they have made much more of an investment in their scouting department than any other team. They've got twice as many people. Now, they haven't figured it out yet. They've got an interesting mix. They have put a lot of weight in the analytics side, but they also have a lot of people on the ground. And they've got a lot of scouting assistants to kind of help service them and do things and what have you. If all that energy they've applied to the evaluation model, if they ever figure that out, then they're going to be way ahead of everyone else and everyone else is going to be following them. It's just difficult to be the first one down that road and to really try to trial and error until you get it right.
Well, it's interesting. It's worked for the Yankees and the Dodgers. It's worked for, you know, the Clippers team that they have now. They're sort of their information ahead. We just saw the Nets make their head coaching hire with Steve Nash. They have a robust staff that has helped them position themselves to get players like Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving. At the end of the day, yes, it's the players, but it's the strategy that's going to get you into the position there. So theoretically, people will look around and maybe realize sooner than later that's the direction that things are moving in. Thank you so much for joining us today. Before you go, where can people get the book? Where can they find you?
It's on Amazon. It's easy to find. Scout Speak, Neil Stratton. And, you know, everyone knows Amazon at this point. My gosh, most people spend half their lives on it. I know my wife does. As far as where to find me, we have the site, InsideTheLeague.com. I have a free blog. It's SucceedInFootball.com, where we talk about a lot of football topics. And we also have something called the Friday Wrap, which is a weekly newsletter that comes out Friday afternoons at 6:30 p.m. Central Time. We talk about a lot of different topics across the industry. if you follow me on Twitter, if you go to my Twitter page at Inside the League, there's a link there where you can register for it. And we'd love to have you. People across the industry read the Friday Wrap. It's always a lot of fun to put together. It's, you know, we try to put a lot of different insights and observations there. And of course, we talk about the book there as well.
Check it out. Scout Speak, Thinking and Talking About Being an NFL Evaluator by Neil Stratton. Again, the foreword by Jeff Ireland of the Saints. Everybody that wants to really get the behind the scenes insight, I think that's for the fans fan right there, and for the industry insider, of course.
Guys, it's an honor to be here, and I really appreciate you both. Thank you for your time.
Thanks a lot, man.
On that note, we're going to sign off. On behalf of my co-host, Aaron Schatz, our guest, Neil Stratton, our producer, Justin Stein, who deserves a double shout-out because I missed him at the top of the show, I'm Matt Manicharian, and thank you for joining us for the latest episode of the Off the Charts Football Podcast.